Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 18th, 2009. For the past 8 years, media reformers in Washington, D.C. and around the country have generally been battling the Bush administration over issues ranging from internet neutrality to media ownership to government propaganda and a host of other issues. A new administration takes office come this Tuesday. How will that change the terrain for media reformers? That's what we'll be talking about today. We'll have two of the leaders of the movement from Washington, Ben Scott and Derek Turner. So please join us today on Media Matters. But first, before we go to Ben and Derek, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
President-elect Barack Obama has chosen his Harvard classmate, Julius Genachowski, to head the Federal Communications Commission. Genachowski served as advisor to former FCC Chairman Reed Hunt and was an executive at Barry Diller's IAC, which owns websites such as Match.com and Evite. Genachowski currently co-leads the Technology Innovation and Government Reform Group for the Obama transition team. Genachowski's nomination must be confirmed by the Senate. That may come quickly so he can oversee the digital television conversion, which is set for February 17th, but may be postponed. Gigi Sohn, president of Public Knowledge, says that under Genachowski's direction, the FCC will shift its focus to the internet as an important means of communication.
Up until now, focus has largely been on telephone companies and cable companies, what their role is in our communication system, also on broadcasters. I think Julius, with his combination of public policy experience and business experience, is going to shift the focus quite a bit to the internet and making sure that it's open and robust and competitive.
On the issue of media ownership, Sohn believes that Genachowski will focus on opening new avenues for new voices.
Nobody is going to turn back the clock and say, okay, now you can only own, 100 radio stations nationwide. This is not going to happen. It's not realistic. But what you can do is you can open other channels of communication, particularly using the underutilized and unused public airwaves or spectrum. That's a good way to do it, and I think he's going to focus on that.
Although Genachowski's priorities on issues like net neutrality may be more in line with the goals of public interest groups, Sohn says that the role of those groups as watchdogs will not change.
A lot of us in the public interest community are seeing our friends and people we've had dinner parties with the last 15, 20 years get into high roles in government, and we have to be willing to say, look, I don't like what you're doing. This is not the right thing for the public interest. So maintaining that independence, just as we were in a more hostile environment, is critically important.
Sohn believes the time has come to reform the agency to restore the public's confidence that it will meet its legal obligations to promote the public interest. Public Knowledge has created a website that invites public discussion about meaningful reform to this important institution.
We are actively soliciting citizen input, and the goal is to give all this input to the new chairman and the commissioners. We will actually deliver these suggestions in these papers and hope that they make it part of their agenda.
To find out more about reforming the FCC, go to fcc-reform.org.
To ring in the new year, we asked media reformers their media wishes for 2009.
My name is Pete Friedrich, and I'm with the Prometheus Radio Project. And my wish for the new year is that just like every town has a public library that people can go to and read books and magazines and see things, I would hope that by the end of the year, every town would have a community radio station where everybody can take part in public debate and showcase local culture and talk to their neighbors about the issues that affect them. That would be my hope for the new year.
Barbara Popovich, Executive Director of CAN-TV, Chicago Access Network Television in Chicago. In 2009, I encourage all media reform advocates to make a vigorous commitment to carving out public space on any media that's on the move. Secondly, peg access channels on cable systems have developed in significant ways in the past. I'd like those lessons learned to help build a foundation for public media in the future.
Hello, I'm Sasha Meinrath. I work with the New America Foundation, a D.C.-based think tank. 2009 is going to be a bellwether year. New digital technologies, an unprecedented consumer demand for innovative solutions, and a forward-thinking administration dedicated to change have created a critical juncture in telecommunications history. We have an unparalleled opportunity to set an agenda that will shape the trajectory of communications for generations to come. This year, we have a responsibility to be even more actively engaged in supporting the progressive reforms we've been working towards for decades. So let's ensure that our leaders make the decisions that we want and support equitable and just communications for all people.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live today, January 18th, 2009, coming to you on WILL AM 580. Today we have as our guests two of the most prominent figures in the media reform movement in the United States. Two people have been guests on this program in the past, and I'm delighted to welcome them again. First, we have Derek Turner, the research director from Free Press based in Washington, D.C. Derek, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Wonderful. And also with us, we have Ben Scott, the policy director for Free Press, who's been a guest many times and who, as many longtime listeners know, was the first producer of Media Matters going back now 6.5 years, dare I say it. Ben Scott, are you there?
I'm here. Good to be back, Bob.
It's good to have both of you with us. And I should say, for editorial disclosure, that I was one of the founders of Free Press and currently do serve on its board. So I have a relationship with both these gentlemen that goes beyond this interview today. Ben and Derek, before we get into all the turf to cover with what's happening with media politics in Washington and nationally and what's going to be coming up in the next year, I do want to ask both of you, as residents of the Washington, D.C. area, what the mood is like in Washington in anticipation of the inauguration of Barack Obama on Tuesday.
I'll field that one first. It's pretty electric, I have to say. I think everyone is anticipating something unlike anything they've ever seen before. I read in the Washington Post this morning that they're expecting somewhere north of 2 million people to descend on the city and try to crowd their way onto the National Mall, watch one of a couple of dozen jumbotrons that are staged around the edge of the mall in frigid temperatures to see Barack Obama inaugurated.
Derek, any thoughts that you might have on this?
Just like Ben said, people's face you see on the train, I think people just feel a sense of hope and optimism. And, you know, we're in a city that is a city of government. And I think, you know, a lot of people are very excited, no matter on what side of the political aisle you're on, that there's an administration coming in that's actually serious and excited to govern. I think for the past 8 years, we've really had an administration that really didn't take the governing process very seriously. So I think, you know, in a city of bureaucrats, I think a lot of bureaucrats are happy that there's actually about to be some real work done.
You know, one of the areas that Free Press works in, that's not the only turf by any stretch for media reform and the range of issues that both of you work on, is the Federal Communications Commission. And just in this last week, Barack Obama's choice to be the new chair of the FCC, Julius Genachowski, was announced. And I'd like your response as to what we should make of Julius Genachowski. Ben, I know you've worked with him in the past. Why don't we start with you?
Sure. Well, I know Julius. I've known him for going on 2 years now. He's a very, very smart guy who's been in this business for a long time, both on the governing side and on the business side. And his pedigree is pretty impressive. In addition to being a classmate of Barack Obama's at Harvard Law, which put him in this circle to begin with, he's also a former Supreme Court clerk. He worked in the House of Representatives and served as staff for the Iran-Contra Select Committee in the 80s. He was chief counsel to Reed Hundt, who was the chairman of the FCC in the first Clinton administration. He then went into business with Barry Diller, the noted media tycoon who started Interactive Corporation, a sort of internet company conglomerate that was one of the big high flyers in the tech boom of the late 90s, early 2000s. He sold high and went into the venture capital business for the last several years and has been there ever since. There are few people, I think, who have had the job of FCC chair who have been at the executive level in the business world like he has, but have also come from a very public-spirited government background. So it's an interesting combo. It remains to be seen what Julius takes on as his primary agenda, but I have the highest hopes and expectations for him that he's going to be a breath of fresh air.
While I'm on this, I know that there are five members of the FCC. Julius will be the chair, and the way the law is written, the Democrats now, since they control the White House, will be entitled to have three of the five seats. Are there any other seats open? What's the makeup of the new FCC going to look like, Ben?
There are going to be other seats open. You know, at the end of December, one of the Republican commissioners, Debbie Tate from Tennessee, her term expired, and she resigned from her seat, so that seat is open. Kevin Martin, the current chairman, just announced just a couple of days ago that he was going to resign on Inauguration Day, so he will be gone. So that seat will be open. The only remaining Republican is Robert McDowell from Virginia. He will stay on the commission. That leaves 2-1 currently majority to the Democrats with Commissioner Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, both of whom I know have been guests on the show. Copps, his term doesn't expire until 2010, I believe. And Jonathan Adelstein's term has expired, but he is permitted to sit through the end of this Congress unless he is either renominated or someone else is nominated to take his place. So we could see both the Democrats in the stay on with Julius, or we could see Jonathan Adelstein move on. Or, you know, it's not impossible that there could be a whole new clean slate, although I think Commissioner Copps is planning on staying.
Derek Turner, what sort of issues do you see coming before the FCC in the next 12 months, the big issues, the ones that Free Press will be working on, that you'll be paying attention to? What are the big ones?
Well, the biggest one is not necessarily a core issue for Free Press, but it's something that we're going to definitely be involved in, and I think it's going to suck all the attention of all the policymakers in Washington over the next couple months, is the issue of the transition to digital television.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, right now, all analog broadcasts are scheduled to end on February 17th.
And for the sake of some of our listeners who aren't really hip to the terminology, by analog, you mean traditional television broadcasting.
That's right. You know, you put the rabbit ears on your television and you get a little bit of a snowy, fuzzy picture. That conversion is going to change to a digital picture. It's much more efficient use of spectrum. It's a much cleaner picture, but it does require people who are still using the rabbit ears to upgrade either their television or to go out and buy a $40 or $50 converter box. And the government currently has a coupon program to help lower the cost of that, but they've essentially run out of money right now. So everyone's sort of walking around pulling their hair out in Washington, and it looks like it may get extended. This transition may get extended until June. So right now, I think that's going to be the first issue that's really going to suck up a lot of the commission's time. Mr. Jenikowski won't be confirmed right away, so I think over the next month or two, you'll likely see Commissioner Copps be likely appointed as the interim chairman and pretty much have a singular focus on the issue of DTV. But as soon as that clears, I think one of the biggest things that we're going to be pushing for is the issue of network neutrality and an open internet and bringing competition into our internet and broadband markets. And then a little bit over the longer term, in 2010, the commission is slated to once again revisit its media ownership rules. It has to do that by law every 4 years. And 2010, believe it or not, is coming up soon, and that fight may happen again. But this time it's going to happen under people who have a much different point of view about the issue.
Now, Derek, if I can get back to the conversion from analog to digital TV to make this clear so there's no confusion. As I understand it, if someone currently receives their television signal primarily through a cable system or a satellite, they have nothing to worry about. It's only people who exclusively use their antenna to get a signal that it could be an issue.
That's right. Only about 13% of households in the U.S. have just over-the-air television. So it's those people who are the only ones affected. If you're a satellite viewer and you don't use rabbit ears, or if you're a cable viewer, there's nothing's going to be even different at all. You won't notice anything different. So for most viewers, it won't be a problem, but primarily this is a concern because the elderly, the low-income households, those are the ones that are most impacted by this, and are, particularly with the elderly, aren't very tech-savvy, and they don't know what the digital transition means, even though there's been public service announcements and things like that. So, you know, I think it's important that we get this right and that we make sure that at least people have the converter boxes that the government said that they pay for, and that way people don't miss having a lifeline, really, to news and information that oftentimes is the only way that they can get their local news and information through the television.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. You've just been listening to Derek Turner, the research director for Free Press. Also on the air with us from the Washington area is Ben Scott, the policy director for Free Press. We're talking about media activism and media policy reform work that will be going on over the next year, especially in Washington in view of the new administration coming into power on Tuesday. Ben Scott, right now, Derek Turner just mentioned the issue of network neutrality, net neutrality, which we've talked a great deal about on this program over the past 2 or 3 years. But I still think there are some folks who might not be familiar with it or are listening to the show. Can you tell folks what we mean by network neutrality and explain where it's at politically? Because I've been confused about this myself. I suspect some of our listeners have. Is this an issue where Congress can just pass a law and make it the law of the land, or is this an FCC issue? Where does whose court is the ball in on network neutrality?
Let me start at the top and sort of explain what it means. I think the easiest way to explain that neutrality is just to imagine yourself sitting in front of your computer. You fire up your Internet Explorer, your web browser, and you start clicking around the Internet. You look at different websites. You look at, your cousin's blog. You go to the New York Times website. You check out WILL.org and see all the websites on the Internet that you're interested in a given day. And every website is pretty much loads the same. All the services work in the same way. It's an equal platform, a neutral platform, the Internet is. It basically means from the point of view of the user, you have access to any website on the Internet that you like, and you get to decide where you go, and everything works the same for you. That is a concept that has become known as net neutrality. It was built into the technology of the Internet now 40 years ago when scientists and government officials in the 60s built this technology. It was very intentionally built in. It's on a set of principles known as end-to-end. That just means when I send an email to somebody or I send any kind of message over the Internet, the owner of the wires that connect us all together have nothing to say about what I send. They are neutral towards the content that I send over the Internet. That's network neutrality. Now, that has always been the law of the Internet throughout its development over the last few decades, until very recently, about 3 years ago, when the government, in its infinite wisdom and at the behest of some of the most powerful telecom lobbies in Washington, decided to strip that off the Internet and say, you know what, we don't need this neutrality stuff anymore. Telephone companies, cable companies, do whatever you want. Well, that triggered a huge battle in the Congress that we've been playing out and the FCC that we've been playing out over the last several years over whether or not it was actually a good idea or a bad idea to strip that away. Obviously, Free Press has been at the forefront of the fight to restore network neutrality in the law. We think that that is the fundamental principle that built the Internet, made it into the most incredible engine of speech and commerce that the world has seen since the printing press. So we've been very aggressive supporters of that. I'm pleased to say that President-elect Obama has been a strong supporter of network neutrality. He was a sponsor of the original network neutrality bill in the Senate in 2006 when he was a senator. On the campaign trail, he has numerous times expressed his support for network neutrality. It's in his policy platform in a very detailed and sophisticated form. In a speech during the campaign, he said that he would, quote, take a backseat to no one on net neutrality. So as a guy who's been sitting in the front seat on net neutrality for quite some time, I'm pretty happy to have Barack Obama sat next to me for the next 4 years. So that circles us around to where we stand politically.
Yeah.
This issue could be handled at either the Congress or the FCC or both, and in my view, preferably both. What we would really like to see is net neutrality put back in the law. That would mean Congress says, we need to affirmatively say that the Internet is going to be open, it's going to be neutral, and the consumer, the user of the Internet, on both sides of their communications are going to be in charge and not the owners of the network. What would then happen is the commission would make a set of rules based on the law that Congress passed. However, there is sufficient law in the books to permit the commission to make rules even if Congress doesn't pass any new laws. So we will be pushing both at the FCC and in the Congress to try to get net neutrality law back on the books.
Our guests, Ben Scott, who you've just been listening to, and Derek Turner, they are the policy director and research director, respectively, for Free Press, the Media Reform Group. You can learn more about Free Press at www.freepress.net. And you can call in and ask questions or make comments to our guests at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Again, this is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Derek Turner, I just want to follow up a little bit on this whole question of the phone companies and cable companies, because it seems like whenever it comes around to issues that try to keep the Internet open, to make it ubiquitous, to end the digital divide, invariably it seems like the lobby that Free Press and other public interest groups is battling against are the phone and cable companies. And when I see this playing out over and over, I'm reminded of a speech that President-elect Obama gave a year or so ago, and I think he gave repeatedly, where he would talk about healthcare, and he would say, look, if we didn't have a giant pharmaceutical and drug industry in this country, and especially if we didn't have a huge insurance industry, we would obviously have a single-payer healthcare system like they do in the rest of the industrial world. It's the most rational way to establish a healthcare system, the most efficient way. But he said, since we do have these huge industries, we just have to accept them, and we can't really push for single-payer. We make the best giving the power of the insurance companies. And I wonder, is that sort of what we're dealing with in terms of broadband and the Internet with these cable and phone companies? I mean, these guys, are they actually contributing anything of great value here, or are they mostly just parasites?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed equation. I mean, historically in this country, you know, our communication systems have been provided by private companies, albeit in a somewhat unique way in that the old Ma Bell, the old telephone company, was somewhat of a sanctioned monopoly, so it was sort of a quasi-governmental, had heavy regulatory oversight. Cable is a little less the case. It really sprung up naturally from the private market, but it doesn't have to be that way. There's nothing that prevents, economically, there's no reason why a local community or a local utility can't basically start putting up their own towers, laying their own fiber cables in the ground and offering services. And indeed, you do see that in a few communities across the country. Some have been more successful than others. Oftentimes, when they haven't been successful, it's because the phone and cable companies have taken them to court for multiple years and tried to prevent them from actually getting it done. But I think the cable and telephone lobby here in D.C. is essentially it's massive, and they operate on the single principle of no regulation, no government intervention, and that's sort of their knee-jerk position. So I can give you several stories about how Free Press has actually filed comments with the FCC. On matters that aren't very controversial, but the army of telecom lobbyists will actually file in response to us and be very negative about what we say, and then later on we'll have a meeting with some of the higher ups at those companies, and they're like, oh, well, we apologize for that. We just tell our army of lobbyists to oppose everything Free Press says. So I think hopefully going forward, President-elect Obama has sort of pledged to change the tone in Washington, and what that would actually mean to our work is that these phone and cable companies actually try to realize that it's possible to make a healthy profit and to do some things that are in the public interest. So they don't need to be so knee-jerk about everything that we're trying to do to protect the public interest. And I think slowly you start to see some of them come around. I mean, the first big boogeyman on an issue of network neutrality was AT&T. And in the 3 years since, they've actually come a lot further than some of the other companies, and I think are willing to back off their strong opposition to network neutrality. But, it's going to take some time. It's going to take some work. But, I think in the long run, we have to understand that the telephone and cable and Internet market won't ever be a completely municipal-run operation. It won't be completely public operation. It's going to be provided by private companies. And we just need to make sure that there's rules in place that make sure that they don't do anything that hurts the public interest.
Again, our phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. 855, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now to our first caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Yeah, I usually don't try to call in this early, but there's a 2 o'clock group listening session at the Champaign Public Library of Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam Riverside Church year before his death. Probably the reason why. I just wanted to pitch that. But on a broader idea of media reform, and I think Free Press is very well-placed to take this and run with it, and maybe you already started some work on this. I learned from listening to you, Professor McChesney, that in American history there was a case of what I would like to harken back to in some ways, which is there was a subsidy of paper, basically, that promoted the pamphleteers and the newspapers, and that might be something to do now if it was tied with a strong recycling program, but I see it as a analogy in the electronic age, which is to find sort of neutral, politically media bias neutral ways of subsidizing new media. There's actually a non-parochial argument about this, which is the whole idea of the United Nations Human Rights list includes the right to communicate, which is a personal and a group right to communicate, which isn't really talked about much here in the U.S., but it's sort of another thing to hang this kind of idea on, and it seems like Free Press would be a great place. I wonder if anybody's actually talking in those terms. There has been a bit more largesse in the public media sphere since the Democrats have been in, but I don't know if that's the right word, but there have been some subsidies, unexpected subsidies, right after the Democrats came in, and I just wonder whether there can be a campaign to for this broader sort of issue, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller, and I'm going to take the liberty, if I can, because there's so much important material in the question the caller just had, to break it into a couple of parts, and maybe I can divide it between the two of you. And I'll start with, I don't care who starts with it, but the first part of that, I think, would be dealing with the existing subsidies that we do have for media creation, and the most important one of which is what your people are listening to right now, public radio, public television, community radio, like WEFT here in Champaign. What's Free Press's position on expanding or maintaining the subsidy to nonprofit, non-commercial broadcasting, and its vision of that as part of the media reform work going forward?
I'll grab that one. This is Ben. I think, you know, we've always felt that there was a huge amount of media that a democratic society needs and wants that the market is unlikely or unwilling to provide. Historically, that need has been met by public media, public broadcasting, NPR, PBS, WILL, but also community radio, public access television in our cable systems, and any number of alternative media outlets, many of which are moving on to the Internet today. We believe that that need is growing and not shrinking, and that we ought to be expanding the public commitment to public media writ large, all from broadcasting all the way over to the Internet. So we have, in the context, and this is perhaps the most important thing that I took away from the caller's question, you know, we're currently considering in Washington a $1 trillion stimulus bill, a bill to pump public dollars into the economy to try to get people to start spending money, to get businesses to sit back on square footing, but also to use that money wisely to generate as many new jobs and as much public good and public benefit as we can. So we believe that this is a great opportunity to put more money into public media. It is an excellent investment, it's cost-effective, and it reaps all kinds of rewards with its civic sector partners. And public media is dedicated to public service. That means it helps out with education, it helps out with local government, helps out with museums, art, and culture. It is a source of local news, which is really in decline in the commercial marketplace. So investing in public media is not only an important part of our future media policy and the stimulus bill, it's essential.
Ben, do you think we'll get anything in the stimulus package to go to public broadcasting?
Well, that remains to be seen. And this bill is being written in a very short timetable. There's a lot of competing priorities. I think there's general sympathy on the Hill for support for public media. It is not a traditional target for economic stimulus So we're going to have to make the case, and we're going to have to exert some pressure. So, I mean, I would encourage any listener who believes that public media is an important part of their lives and ought to be up there competing for dollars alongside everybody else who's going to get stimulus money to call your senator and indicate that to them. You know, this is an opportunity, a huge opportunity, and we ought to jump on it.
Is Free Press organizing anything publicly? Do they go to the website and get involved in this, or is that still not done yet?
You can go to the website. There's some material on it there. We'll be making a much more significant push after the inauguration. Right now, Washington's sort of in a lull, in a hiatus, waiting for this transition to occur. But at the end of this coming week, it's going to get back hot and heavy.
Derek Turner, let me take up another aspect of the caller's question, which is, you know, probably the great media story that most Americans are going to be familiar with this year won't be the transition to analog to digital television, but it's the ongoing story of the collapse of daily newspaper publishing in the United States. Every day now, it seems like certainly every week, a major newspaper is either curtailing publication, going into bankruptcy, flat out going out of business in a couple of cases. And most of them have seen their stock prices plummet. They're on the market, and the future seems extraordinarily grim. By the end of this year, it seems possible, even likely, that large chunks of this country will have no working reporters covering them at all. For the first time in American history, the market basically has not found it profitable to do so. Are there any steps, any measures that we can do, the approach to recreate journalism or to create journalism so that there is effective media serving communities around this country?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And, you know, Ben raised the issue of how important it is to have a, you know, strong and healthy public media in this country. You know, I think it's just as equally important to have a strong and healthy private media in this country. And, you know, we can look back to the heyday of private journalism, and there's a lot of good things to point to there, but it is in crisis right now. And, you know, it's multifaceted, the reasons it's happening. You know, first of all, the general economy is tanking, and newspapers are not immune to that. Second, during the sort of bubble, the credit bubble that we had leading up, it actually led to a lot of newspaper outlets being purchased at prices that weren't really sustainable and didn't really make a lot of sense, and now they're having a lot of trouble paying off their credit. The obvious case of this is Sam Zell's purchase of the Tribune Company. He's basically, on the backs of the employees, essentially raised a lot of private capital and bought the company for a way inflated price. So it's a crisis in journalism, and you don't really have any obvious solutions to it, but I think fundamentally the market for good investigative journalism is there. It's just that the market's being fragmented by all the other things that newspapers do, such as classified ads or sports or national stories in a lot of cases, when newspapers should be focusing on local things. And so people can get those other types of products elsewhere, and so the market becomes fragmented. I think in the long run, we're going to have to make a commitment to strengthening journalism in this country. And there's a lot of interesting ideas floating around out there. I think it should be a part of the stimulus bill, like Ben mentioned. I think we can do lots of interesting things, like have seed money to fund pointer-like institutes. The St. Petersburg Times is a very good paper that's essentially a nonprofit paper, private but nonprofit, and there's a journalism institute down there. If we funded institutions like that nationwide, or sort of had like a AmeriCorps Job Corps program for journalists. Right now, a lot of journalism students, when they go do their internships, are unpaid. If we, you know, basically beef that up and paid them, it would greatly help a lot of these papers train the next generation of journalists, and it would be a great way to stimulate the economy. So there's not a shortage of ideas. We need more ideas, and this is something I think we really have to focus on in the long run. We need a healthy private media, and we need to help these newspapers make the transition into the 21st century. Because if we don't, just like you said, a lot of cities we'll have the newspaper disappear, and there will be essentially no outlet for local news other than the television news stations, which I'm sure your listeners know is not always of the highest caliber of quality.
And by private media, to clarify, because of the St. Petersburg example, if entrepreneurs, businesses, capitalists, pick whatever term you prefer, decide they can't make money doing it, that doesn't mean you can't have this media. It just means you just can't have capitalists doing it. You've got to find someone else to do it.
Well, that's right. And the other thing that I should point out is, there are still a lot of healthy newspapers that aren't part of large chains. A lot of the problem is that the industry, especially the publicly traded companies, demands constant growth.
And the newspaper industry is just not an industry of growth. It can only grow to a sustainable size. Now, profit margins are still quite very healthy in the newspaper industry. They're not the same as the monopoly 50, 60% margins of 20 years ago, but they're still above 15 or 20%, which is, I wish I had a 15 or 20% return on an investment. So it's not a growth industry, but it is an industry that's very profitable, and I think it's going to take, essentially getting the Wall Street mentality out of our news and having it be more of a sort of ma-and-pa type operation where they keep the lights on, they pay the journalist, and they earn a decent profit.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today with Derek Turner, who you just listened to, the research director at Free Press in Washington, D.C. Also on the line with us is the policy director for Free Press, Ben Scott, who cut his teeth as the first producer of Media Matters back in 2002 and 2003, so he's well known to many of our longtime listeners. The phone numbers here at WILL AM 580 are 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Scott and Turner.
Did you say line 2?
I did indeed.
Thank you. We've been moving around in this conversation through a lot of media, and I realize there's some interrelations between things. I'd like to focus a minute on the Internet and see how the net neutrality plays out. You've kind of defined what that is in principle. What kinds of things should I be looking for as an interested party and be concerned about a lack of neutrality might affect?
Yeah, Ben, why don't you field that one?
Sure. It's an important question because it is hard to guard against that which has not yet occurred. However, we have begun to see the intentions of the telephone companies and the cable companies who own the networks. You know, they're acting rationally in their own financial interests. They're asking themselves the questions, okay, I have control over a big chunk of the marketplace for Internet subscribers. What could I do, given that I own the network, to make more money? So among the ideas that they have, which they have talked about publicly, this is hardly a secret, they've said, well, what we'll do is we'll go to the richest Internet companies in the world. We'll go to the Googles and the Yahoos and the Amazons and the Microsofts, and we'll say to them, hey, guys, you know, you're on top of the heap right now, but you're on the Internet, and the Internet is anything... is incredibly fickle in terms of popularity. Don't you think you'd like to lock in your dominance in your space, whether you're a bookseller or a search engine or an email program or an online video provider or iTunes? You know, here's an opportunity for you. We will sell you primo Internet service. Your website will be 10 times faster than any other website. You'll be able to do things for Internet subscribers that nobody else can do, and essentially you'll become a super Internet. Consumers will realize after a while that there's no point going to anybody else's website that does something like what you do because you're just so much better than them. And it turns the Internet into a pay-for-play system. Now, that may not sound so bad in the short term. You've got some really interesting things that could be done, and those guys would go super fast. But over the long term, what it means is all of the innovations, all of the new things that, you know, we never heard about 3 years ago, YouTube, you know, we never heard of YouTube 3-4 years ago, now it's ubiquitous. You know, all Instant Messenger, all of the different and various technologies that have been developed, they don't get developed if we have a lockdown and a pay-per-play Internet. Furthermore, you know, connecting this to our earlier conversation about what the future of media looks like if newspapers are in decline and everybody's going digital, you know, we need to make it the Internet a place not for the reification of the power structure of the old media. We don't want to have gatekeepers like we do in broadcasting and newspapers and cable. We want the Internet to be this wide open space for anybody to go online and have their voice heard. So really, if we go into a non-neutral Internet, the opportunity for anybody to have a website that's a television station, anybody to have a website that's a radio station, anybody to have a website that's a newspaper really is diminished dramatically because suddenly, the first thing you have to do before you get that privilege is you got to go get permission from your local cable and phone companies, and that is not a scenario that lends itself to democratic media.
Derek Turner, let me turn to another matter, something you referred to a couple times already in the program, and an issue that I think most people are first to associate with the media reform movement, with free press, and that's the issue of media ownership. In view of the collapse of all these media companies and their struggles and how they're selling off assets, is the issue of media ownership now a dead letter? Does that no longer have any resonance?
Well, I don't think it's a dead letter. What I do think is that the consolidation model has been tried, and it's been an economic failure. For example, the cross-ownership model, what we refer to when a local newspaper also owns a local television station. That model is one that we're particularly concerned about because newspapers essentially generate most of the local news, and television stations are really their only competitor. When you start merging them, we really worry about one-voice communities. That model has been tried. The biggest proponent of that model is, who I mentioned earlier, the Tribune Company has the most cross-owned properties. It's been a failure. So the big media conglomerates won a small partial victory last year, in 2007, and getting some of the cross-ownership rules changed in their favor. However, the media reform movement was actually able to hold back proposed changes to other rules in television stations, and particularly proposed changes by companies like Clear Channel to be even larger in the radio sphere. I don't think it's a dead issue. I think what we're actually going to try to push for and we're going to see is a push to deconcentrate local media and a push to get local media stations into the hands of local owners who are going to take a better care of that property and are going to do a better job serving the public. You know, study after study shows that if you're a local owner, you're more likely to be in touch with your community. You're more likely to cover the issues that your local community cares about. And we think we can use this time of economic upheaval, combine that with some deconcentration in the media ownership rules and maybe some tax incentives, and we can start getting stations into the hands of people who are local, who don't care about making super growth every quarterly return in their statement to their shareholders. Just local owners who care about serving their local communities. So it's certainly not a dead issue, and I think you're going to see it sort of merge with some of the internet issues. But traditional media still plays a large role in delivering news and information to citizens. I mean, there's a lot of people get their national news from the internet, but there's certainly not a lot of local news that's produced on the internet unless it's produced by the local newspaper or local television station.
Well, Derek Turner, could we see something as dramatic as FCC media ownership rules that would, limit the number of stations a single person could own, a radio and TV stations, similar to what we had 20, 30, 40 years ago, and even put an emphasis on encouraging ownership to be based in the same community? Is that something like that would have seemed outrageously radical 2 or 3 years ago and untouchable? Is that now on the table?
Well, I certainly hope it is. Some of it will require Congress stepping in, so I wouldn't hold my breath there. Congress is notorious for being beholden to industry, even in cases where it doesn't need to be. But I do think the FCC has significant leeway with their rules to do things like shorten the license renewal period for television and radio stations, and to enact regulations that do favor local ownership and things like favoring local content and things like that. It's not out of the realm of possibility that this FCC would do that. And certainly with Commissioner Copps taking over as interim chairman for the time being, and I'm sure when full chairman Jenikowski comes on, he'll look to Commissioner Copps' leadership on these issues. I think it's very possible that we can see some movement of the media ownership rules back into the favor of the public.
Now, you've mentioned Congress, Derek Turner, as has Ben Scott, our other guest. As bills work their way concerning media ownership, internet issues, anything to deal with media and communication, they don't just go through the general House and Senate. They go clearly directly through certain committees where all the power really lies on these issues. Ben Scott, what are the relevant committees in the House and Senate that you're going to be dealing with on media policy, and who's chairing them this session, and what's your sense of the makeup of these committees?
Well, there's been a major change in the Congress, just as there has been, of course, in the White House. In both cases, in House and Senate, the most important committee for these issues is the Commerce Committee. The Energy and Commerce Committee in the House and the Commerce Committee in the Senate. In the House, it has been chaired for decades by a congressman from Michigan, John Dingell, whose father also held the seat and actually was one of the original authors of the Communications Act of 1934
Dingell has sat in that chair for many, many years. John Dingell, now in his 80s, has stepped aside. He was challenged for the seat of chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee by the spring chicken, 60-some-year-old Henry Waxman from California. Congressman Waxman is now the chairman of Energy and Commerce. He is, I would say, an excellent vote on media reform issues. When he won the chair, we went through his record and looked at all the issues from net neutrality to media ownership to low-power radio across the board. And we couldn't find a single vote where Congressman Waxman had voted against the interests of the public. So that's good news for those of us watching things happening in the House. Congressman Ed Markey, who's long chaired the Telecommunications Subcommittee, has decided to swap gavels with it's been a very long-time friend of ours and a long-time friend of the media reform movement, has moved over, and he's going to chair the Energy Subcommittee and work on global warming issues. All I can say is that the environment better start cooling, because losing Ed Markey from telecom is a very bittersweet for us, because he's been such a great champion. But Congressman Boucher, also a strong supporter of net neutrality, a smart guy, very well known as a tech-savvy congressman, which is not something you often hear in the same sentence. So that's the House. In the Senate, the Senate Commerce Committee has been chaired for the last 2 years by Senator Inouye from Hawaii. He's moved over to chair the Appropriations Committee, and now Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia is the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee. That should make for interesting times. Jay Rockefeller is sort of an aggressive legislator. He's got lots of good ideas, and I think we can look for that committee to be very active in this Congress.
Let's go back to you, if I can, Derek Turner. I'd like to just take up a couple other Internet issues. As we go to a media system that's going to be largely digital, overwhelmingly everything will be done on ubiquitous digital systems, be they iPods or cell phones or Blackberries or computers, but everyone connected basically to the network. What other sort of issues are starting to emerge that you've got your eye on? And the ones that I'm thinking about deal with issues of privacy, keeping users of material, their information confidential and not being exploited by commercial interests or government interests, and also commercialism online. Are these issues you're flagging for future work, Derek Turner?
Well, you know, we definitely are very concerned about the privacy issues. I mean, the Internet, it's a great platform to communicate with people that you've never, you know, you would never otherwise communicate with, but that is a double-edged sword in the sense that you put yourself out there, and there's a lot of, a lot of information that's available about you, and there's, because of digital storage, it's easy for every click you make on the Internet to be stored in a server somewhere, and then a profile of you compiled and then advertising targeted directly towards you. So yes, this is an issue we were very concerned about, because some of the same technologies that would be used to violate network neutrality are the same technologies that are going to be used to violate your privacy. These are the so-called deep packet inspection technologies, which essentially, if you think of the Internet as in the sense of the old, mail system, you send a letter to someone over the Internet. This technology essentially allows the letter carrier to open and read your mail and then seal it back without you ever knowing. Those technologies are very troubling, and we're actually, there was a push by a couple of companies last year to start deploying those technologies in order to target advertising on the Internet towards specific audiences. Fortunately, Congress stepped in, and all it had to do was essentially call some people up to the Hill and ask some questions, and the main company that was promoting this technology pretty much went out of business right away. So, that's a very encouraging result. Some of the other issues that I think we're going to be working on, and which is one that's near and dear to me, is just the issue of basic connectivity. I truly believe that Internet access and broadband itself is the great equalizer. It's something that allows people, a leg up and the ability to participate in the marketplace and the economy in ways that were never possible before. It lowers barriers, and it's a way of making people who are traditionally shut out of the higher economic opportunities be able to participate. But that requires people actually getting connected to the Internet, being able to afford it, being able to afford computers. So one of the things I'm going to be looking at here in the next couple of months is there's a program right now that helps subsidize telephone service for low-income families. I think that program needs to be extended to subsidizing broadband internet access for low-income families, particularly families with children, because it's, you know, if we're going to maintain our global competitiveness, it's very important that all elements of our society are involved on the internet and are connected and have the same opportunity as those who are more affluent among us.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's first go to line one, Urbana. You're on the air with Ben Scott and Derek Turner.
Yes. I think my question is more pertaining to, like, television and newspapers. But in my opinion, because of the media ownership being so concentrated, it seems like there's a clear right-wing bias, in my opinion. And I was just wondering if you support a sort of, like, fairness doctrine with programs, and if so, if you think this new administration, there might be some way to make more, like, news programs a little less biased. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Ben Scott, fairness doctrine. Is it time to tee that one up?
It may come as a surprise to some of your listeners from me to say, no, I don't think it is, and here's why. It's not because I don't believe in the idea of fairness. I certainly do, and I think it's a laudable goal. The fairness doctrine, however, is a piece of policy that existed 30, 40 years ago. It was put out of business in the mid-'80s when it was taken off the books as a result of a legal challenge. The fairness doctrine said two things. It said, number one, that broadcast stations, radio, and television need to cover issues of importance to their local communities, and number two, that they needed to do that in an even-handed way. Now, that suggests that, and this was the law that really made broadcasting balanced, that made it objective, that made journalism not lean to the left or to the right. In reality, if you look at the number of complaints that were filed under the Fairness Doctrine, which you would have expected to be significant parts of making that law work, there actually weren't that many, and the number that were actually successfully prosecuted were minuscule. The Fairness Doctrine didn't really work in the way that it has its reputation suggests that it might, that it did. Furthermore, you get into a really difficult situation with the Fairness Doctrine where you've got government regulators in Washington, largely at the Federal Communications Commission, who would be in a position of deciding for the American public what's fair and what's not fair. Now, when you're talking about political issues, you know, depending on who's in power and who's at that agency, their opinion of what's fair politically and what's okay is gonna be just as varied as the political opinions of average Americans. So I think on the whole, that sort of content regulation is very, very difficult to do correctly, if not impossible to do correctly. I think that if the Fairness Doctrine were to be brought back, it would get thrown out by the courts, and probably rightly so. And the answer, therefore, in my opinion, to the issue of fairness and the issue of bias, because, of course, there's tons of bias in the media, is not the Fairness Doctrine. It's not content regulation. It is the expansion of speech. We need more voices in the media system. We need to expand the ownership base of radio and television stations so that there are simply more voices out there, so that we can get back to the old Jeffersonian ideal of the marketplace of ideas, where there are all kinds of competing perspectives that are very unabashedly partisan, very unabashedly ideological, but there are so many choices competing for the attention of the viewer, listener, that you really get perspectives.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller now on Media Matters. Let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Ben Scott and Derek Turner.
Yes, my question has to do with the very issue of more voices available in the media. A number of years ago, there was a movement toward the initiation of what amounted to radio stations that, you have to put broadcast in quotes, over the Internet. And my understanding is that a regulation was passed at the behest of the regular radio stations that changed the way that the holders of music copyrights were compensated for the use of their properties in such a way that it made it economically impossible for the Internet radio stations to continue, and most of them went out of business. I'm wondering whether you have any hope that that might be changed.
Derek, why don't you field that one?
Sure. Yeah, this is a really important issue, and it's really rather unfortunate. It's an example of how a powerful lobby can essentially crush a new medium in its infancy. Right now, over-the-air radio essentially doesn't pay that much, or if anything, in a lot of cases, to the holders of copyright for airing music. It's traditionally been thought of, probably rightly so, as essentially free advertising for the songwriter and for the artist. Their music is out there, is being heard, and it causes more people to buy their albums. When satellite radio came along, they were forced to pay a little bit more, but not a whole lot more than the broadcast radio system did. But when internet radio came along, for some reason, it was viewed as a complete threat to both the traditional radio industry and to the artist community. And they were essentially, through a ruling of a sort of private body, were attached very ridiculous amounts of royalty fees that they had to pay. And in a lot of these cases, these radio stations were just people in their garage with a small home computer and their own record collection, you know, streaming stuff across the internet. I mean, some people, in the month of December, they would start a Christmas music radio station with all their Christmas albums. And obviously, they're not taking any advertising, and they're in no position to actually pay royalties whatsoever. Unfortunately, the fight that happened over that late 2007, early 2008 really went nowhere, and I think right now it's sort of in limbo, and it's not looking good for the internet radio industry. Companies like Pandora, which I think is a very innovative company, you actually enter in an artist that you want to listen to, and it takes you to similar artists. They're one of the biggest radio broadcasters on the internet, and they are in serious financial trouble right now, and look like they're going to go belly up here sooner than later. So this is something I hope that the incoming Congress will pay attention to and won't let the traditional arguments about copyright get in the way of understanding this is actually a good medium to promote music and to promote artists that aren't going to get radio airplay on the traditional broadcast station.
Ben Scott, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'd like to close, if I can, by having you address, to step back a second and address the trajectory and the state of the media reform movement today. You've been active now for nearly 6 years as a day-to-day participant, going back to your days working in Congressman Bernie Sanders' office on media ownership issues in the summer of 2003. And, you know, at that point, Free Press barely existed. How big is the media reform movement today? Who are its players, and what does its future look like to you?
I think that it's one of the most remarkable stories in contemporary American politics, and I don't want to say that in a self-serving way since I've been a part of it. But, you know, literally, when this got started 6 years ago, we were a ragtag bunch, you know. There were a handful of outstanding consumer advocates in Washington who had been doing this work for many years, and there were a wide variety of local groups that had been working, in many cases, in isolation on issues of media representation and alternative media production. But there was no coordinated effort to involve the public in policymaking in Washington. And now, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, we've largely fought a defensive battle. We've been pushing back against, you know, the worst form of market fundamentalism that said all regulation is bad and the public interest has no place in a capitalist media marketplace. We've won a bunch of successful defensive battles. We've won a couple of really impressive offensive battles, I think. And now we're you know, 6 years from day one, we're about to enter into a new administration whose policy agenda on media and telecommunications is virtually identical to our own.
And Ben Scott, let me just thank you very much for your comments. Derek Turner, thank you also for joining us today here on Media Matters. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to get me out of the studio, and you're familiar with that, Ben. Thank you both very much. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for being the engineer today, Andrew Boyle, my producer. Both Ben and Derek, good luck to you and your work in the coming year, and we hope to stay in touch with you.
Thanks.
All right, and then I will be back in 167 hours with Susan Douglas talking about Media Matters of all things. My name's Bob McChesney. Thank you all so much for listening. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, scattered flurries today with a high of 28 degrees. Tonight's low 10. Tomorrow, a chance of flurries with a high of 25 and low of 15 degrees. Tuesday, partly cloudy skies with a high of 32 degrees. Tuesday night, partly cloudy with a low of 18. This is WILL, AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a broadcast service of